Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome again to Lee and the IC, the podcast that gets to quiz Lord John Lee, one of the UK's most successful and best-known personal investors. I'm Alex Newman, an associate editor at the Investors Chronicle, once again doing the quizzing, and I am joined here both by the man himself and also no fewer than three other guests this month who I'll be introducing in a moment. John, thanks as ever for joining me.
My pleasure.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. Early morning swim and one or two encouraging trading statements.
Oh, lovely. And rounded off with a podcast.
And rounded off with a podcast.
What a perfect day. So as is customary, let me just first make the disclaimer that any stocks or companies discussed on this podcast should not be taken as financial advice or recommendation to buy or sell anything. As ever, listeners are encouraged to do their own research. This month, I'm going to be speaking with John about the latest moves in his portfolio, including a takeover bid for one of his larger holdings and two companies where he's been reinvesting the proceeds. We'll also be fielding some listener questions. But we're going to kick things off by returning to a common theme for this podcast, which is financial education. In a sense, everything in this series has had an educational element. Often we've used the companies and stocks John invests in as a kind of a lens to understand the market, his approach to investing, and how to manage your own money. But we've also talked a fair bit about financial education or the lack thereof in UK schools and John's efforts to persuade the government to use its impending sales of NatWest shares to bring investing into the classroom. Alongside that, we've touched on the idea of some companies issuing shares to help build an investing club culture and increase their outreach within their communities. Well, today we have the honour of speaking with a London-based charity with plans to bring investing to life for the young people it works with. I'm hoping we can all learn a lot about what it takes to set up an investment fund, both for and managed by young people, and the hopes of the people leading the project. So joining me and John to discuss this is Sat Singh, the founder and CEO of the Renaissance Foundation, and Ananya Chowdhury and Wahid Uddin, both of whom went through the Renaissance programme and have now agreed to co-chair the investment committee being set up. It's lovely to have you all here. Thanks for being here. Sat, could I start with you just by asking if you to just briefly introduce Renaissance and where you're based, why it exists, and what it does.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Alex. So I'm Sat. I'm from Renaissance Foundation. So we are a specialist youth charity. We're based not too far from here now. We're based in Aldgate. We've got a youth hub where young people from across London can come in after school. We have weekly drop-ins. And essentially, we're an inspiration charity. So supporting young people who have care and responsibilities or health conditions that might be affecting them at home or with their school life. And really, we feel that by giving them inspirational experiences along with a peer support multi-year program, we can help people reach their potential.
Brilliant. And so how did you land on the idea for a youth investment fund? Because I looked at some of the work you do. I mean, it's really broad. You're sending young people to Norway to have a look at the Nobel Foundation's work. And there's lots of other meeting experiences. Why finance? Why investing?
Yeah, so I think part of our theme is if you're having a challenge for anyone, whatever age, but we tend to find, you know, when things are difficult in life, especially like I grew up having sort of care and responsibilities and health challenges, and it can often be sort of, why am I the only person in my class at school who's got this going on? And often people don't share with their friend at school or things, so it's not something that people talk about. And so for us, it's very much about, well, it can often feel like a tidal wave of challenges and why is this situation happening to me? And what things that had a big impact for me and why I set up the charity was that having an inspirational experience sort of stopped that tide of, oh, not just negative things can happen to you in life. Actually, there are positive things. And it's amazing that if you have one inspirational experience, then another, actually you can start to, like a ladder almost, and it just helps pull you out of where you were. And so I had the opportunity to very early on, randomly, I was going through a challenge in time, and I had the real chance to meet Richard Williams, who was Venus and Serena's dad, you know, through a fence at Wimbledon. He was on the other side of the fence, and he said to me, you know, we're like, oh, Richard, would you have a chat with us? You know, having some challenges. And he was like, yeah, I'll meet you at 1 p.m. I'm going to have a smoke break. I'm going to meet on this bench on the other side where the normal people were. And he was in this VIP enclosure. And I'd never met anybody like that before. And then we got there, you know, we thought, oh, we're just happy we met him. And, you know, we didn't think he was going to really meet us there. And then literally we got there a bit late. It was like after two, and he's sitting there having his cigar saying, "You're late." And we're like, "Oh," like, and he goes, "If you want to be successful, you got to be on time, you know?" And then he actually ended up spending, you know, a couple of hours with us, and we only had a day pass, and we actually ended up, he got us Venus and Serena's tickets. We met them, and we were there for the championships. And but that experience, he coached, I didn't realize I had a coaching conversation. I probably had never had that in my life before. And having that experience transformed my life. And that's really where the idea for the charity is, giving young people them inspirational experiences to help. And so we do visits to Wimbledon, to Formula One, to the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. And really, it's giving people them inspirational moments combined with our multi-year program. So you need both, but actually that's what can have a transformation.
I wouldn't mind joining this if there are all these trips. It sounds very exciting, I must say. I've clearly missed out.
And that's probably what brings us to the fund, is that essentially we're about bringing these world-class opportunities that young people don't necessarily have to broaden horizons.
I mean, these are experiences, these are moments that you're hoping are having an impact. Is there also, I suppose, a skills element with trying to build a fund that your young people are going to help manage?
Yeah, 100%. So we almost hide the education in the exciting things. And I think that's really what it's about is, you know, the UK has actually got a world-class financial services industry. It's right around us. But actually the kind of groups and, you know, young people we're supporting sometimes feel like that's not for them, or that, you know, it might seem so far away. And I think by giving young people responsibility and empowering them to sort of, you know, do the asset allocation, or, you know, it's their fund, I think that's what we're trying to do. We are about giving young people meaningful experiences, hands-on skills, and that's really what it's all about. And that's why we're really excited to do this.
Is finance specifically something that they've been asking for, or you see interest there within your service users?
Yeah, so our program's got various themes. It's business entrepreneurship, culture, well-being. So we've got and global citizenship, which fits into the Nobel program. But the business and entrepreneurship, you know, this is an entrepreneurial generation. You know, people have got side hustles, they are watching influencers online and all sorts. So I think that's the thing, is that the young people are very aware of it. And actually, this has come about through a couple of things, really. I think one, we're concerned about the rise of these finfluencers and, you know, crypto things that are not properly regulated. And two, I think it's very much about trying to get young people that we support, you know, into the careers in financial services and careers that you might not know about. If your family, you haven't been to university before, or you don't know what does an analyst do, you know, so actually that's an angle. And I think that the third one is really about inspiring them, because once you get interested in it, and just hearing, you know, Lord Lee's, you know, how you got started when you was a young person and you was going through the magazines, I think actually it's a wonderful journey to actually expose people to, if you might not have that in your family or that opportunity.
So a bit of a boring question, but, you know, really important for getting started in anything, I suppose. What are kind of some of the practical considerations here? So it's the City of London Youth Investment Fund. You're going to be setting up through the Renaissance Foundation. I imagine, you know, in terms of, I suppose, the kind of asset classes you're investing in, you talked a little bit about, you know, the trade-off between certain slightly more risky investments, you know, the structure, funding, timescales. How's it all looking as envisioned?
No, it's been really exciting, actually, process. And so I should probably mention that I'm just also a trustee at another leading charity called Impetus Trust. And it's about all supporting young people with social mobility. It's a much larger charity. It's actually more like an impact philanthropy organisation. And there I've also on the investment committee. But I've also been had oversight. So we're responsible for something called a Youth Endowment Fund. So it's actually from the Home Office, and it's an endowment of more than 200 million. And that's managed by Goldman Sachs Asset Management. And we had a meeting yesterday, funny enough. And so it's been a really good experience for me to understand about asset allocation, what charities can invest in, ESG screening, you know, what you can't invest in. And they've got the, you know, combination of stocks, bonds and various instruments. So it's been a really good way for me to understand, you know, what happens at a larger scale, as well as, you know, speaking to a lot of people that have actually been really supportive. So a few of our supporters and companies that we've got relationships relationships with at the charity have kindly said, we'd love to help with your asset allocation and stock selection. So we're really excited to kind of work with the supporters we've got around us.
Yeah, and we're working out as you're going. So I'm going to bring in the two people who are going to be co-chairing this fund. And Anya, let me start with you. We heard a little bit about your, how RF put you in contact with Oxford University, thinking about, your future academic career. You went there. What's your career been like since university and your sort of journey into the world of investing?
Thank you, Alex, for having us on. So we have instruction since university. I started my career in investment banking, doing M&A in UK M&A, and now I currently work for a growth investor, investing in consumer sector and much earlier stage companies.
Great. And why, when we spoke before last week, I know you said you struggled at school and maybe sort of lacked a bit of direction, but you're now a practicing accountant at a fintech firm, and I understand an investing trader in your spare time. What got you into business finance and the world of investing along the way?
Yeah, I think it really started from Renaissance Foundation sparking that interest in me. There's so many things you can go and do, even though they might seem out of reach. The potential is there if you try and pick something that interests you and build on it and maybe have a career in it, then it can lead to all sorts of new things that you wouldn't have even been made aware of. I never knew what private equity was or mergers and acquisitions and that sort of thing. But, going to the Renaissance Foundation events and talks and seminars and things like that, it really showed me, a different part of the world that I wouldn't have, I don't think I would be exposed to it. So, I think that first sparked an interest, but I always wanted to make sure that I was able to provide for my family, whether it's through, having a good stable income or doing it in a way that, through investments that may return, dividends or a portfolio that, I can safely say would grow over a specific period of time. I wanted to make sure that was the backbone behind it, being the eldest child in my family also. Just making sure that I'm taking care of my family. That was kind of the main reason.
A bit of pressure there as well always helps. you're going to be co-chairing this fund. How do you bring to life investing for a 15-year-old who might be in the RF program, who's potentially you're going to be working with to manage a portfolio?
Sure, I think a 15-year-old who is already thinking about investing, they're already well ahead compared to other people. Firstly, and that in itself is a big thing to have and to hold on to. I think learning about the different types of investments, learning about why a pension is useful, the tax advantages of having an ISA, those sorts of things. I think building up the foundation base of knowledge will definitely help them build on that, sort of like a staircase. When I was young, I'm thinking back to when I was 15. I was thinking about a pension specifically. I thought it's so many years away. I'll probably opt out when I get a job anyway. But, learning more about it and, knowing that the employer contributes, if you don't get to your pension and you die, essentially, it passes on to someone else in your family. So, things like that, people often have questions about it. But if you look into it, there's more parts to it than you might have initially thought when you hear the word pension or ISAs and yeah, those sorts of things.
John, can you remember the spark for you when you were 15, 16, first dabbling in shares? Was it, were you thinking about a legacy already then about pension and
well,
your family?
Well, let me just say that, hearing these three talk and what they're aiming at and what they're trying to do is, for me, is hugely impressive because as compared with them, I really had the advantage of a father who was an investor himself. He was a doctor, and with his modest savings, he invested in the stock market and took the Investors Chronicle and also something called the Stock Exchange Gazette, which was a similar publication, which now no longer exists. For me, there was a sort of family background and a family introduction to investing, and it was relatively easy for me to talk to my father and to dig into those investment publications. From which I started to develop an increasing interest and a degree of excitement. So compared with them, I've had so many advantages, and I'm hugely impressed with what they're setting out to do. And obviously anything that I can contribute in terms of suggestions or ideas, I'm very, very willing to do that.
Yeah, well, I'd love to get onto some of that a little bit later. I suppose your point just goes to show it is experience, isn't it? Whether it's in the home or, you know, through a foundation, where the spark can sometimes come from. And Anya, if I could turn back to you, I mean, you're, as you said, you're a professional investor now at a venture capital firm. Do you have a kind of an approach or philosophy towards investing that you're going to bring to helping to manage this fund?
So our approach to investing that we've decided together as a team, myself, Wahid, and Sat, would be having a combination of both fundamental investing, which would educate the people involved about how to diligently analyze a business, which is what I do on a day-to-day basis and I really enjoy, but then also the macro side of things to help understand economic principles and the environment that governs the market that these businesses exist in. So a combination of those would inform how we decide to allocate assets and the approach that we take to decide which stocks, which ETFs, and which asset types to invest in.
Yeah, so I suppose really, really well-rounded investing approach. The risk with anything, I find when writing or talking about investing, is that it's so multifaceted, multivarious. There are so many options out there. There's so much you could talk about, so much you could invest in. Almost sort of narrowing it down, particularly within the confines of an investment committee, can be a real challenge. I mean, I'll throw this out to the three of you. I mean, how are you going to balance either the risk of on the one hand groupthink, on the other hand, the enormous range of potential for a fund when you're starting out? I don't know if any of you have thoughts on that unfair question.
I think you'll strike a balance through discussion and education, firstly. I think going for the really complex stuff wouldn't make sense, especially, we want to try and create a long-only fund and, in a way that capitalizes on the growth on stocks and ETFs that are, have a trajectory of going up. You know, they say the trend is your friend, right? So I think setting down those principles and key foundations of education, firstly, as Ananya said, the fundamentals are key, because valuing a company's health, what it brings to the table, how profitable it is, and also, if it pays out dividends, being able to compound those dividends back into the portfolio and grow in a way that is much faster than, just putting in money here and there when you feel like it. Having a strategy, I think, is the main thing, but building out that strategy or tweaking it slightly to optimize it, I think that is the way to go, really.
John, I know you've always invested as an individual on your own account, but you have also run portfolios for, I know, there's a foundation you're involved in, or you've been involved in investing funds on behalf of others with a bit of oversight. How do things change when you're doing things a bit more collaboratively as an investor? Does it affect decision making? Does the risk reward balance that you would normally keep in your own mind change a little bit?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I've been involved, I think, in two or three small, similar to investment clubs, basically, where there've been a number of people involved and taking decisions. And I have to say that hasn't really worked out. I never really made much money from it. They've not been over successful, really. So I enjoy much more focusing on and taking my own decisions. What I wasn't clear about from talking to the three was whether you're planning to invest in individual companies and select the companies, or whether you're going to invest in funds. I'm very much focused on investing in individual companies, and I detected that was the way you were intending to go as well, rather than investing in funds, which is something that I very much favour and would encourage you to do. But I'm just interested in discovering whether, in fact, that is the way you're planning to go ahead.
Yeah, I think that is the plan. Mainly, equity is heavy in terms of picking the right companies that pay out dividends and are beneficial, but also having a balanced portfolio, some exposure to some safe havens, maybe gold, for example, and bonds and rates and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think mainly equities and companies that are beneficial, that look like they're long-term, they're promising and they can provide value for us as the investor.
Is that about investing in in kind of what you know or what you can see in the world, what you can understand, companies you've got a real handle on or you deal with in your everyday life? What's your thoughts there on sort of familiarity?
To come back to your question on groupthink and how to avoid that when you are investing almost by definition in companies that you don't know intimately, our approach is to A, encourage as insofar as possible independent thought. So maybe one individual might have a lot of intimate knowledge about this specific sector or this specific company, and others won't, and encourage that so that we can all come together and analyze it, and so it's held to the same benchmark as it would otherwise. And then also little strategies that we've picked across our professional careers and how to enact that on a day-to-day basis. Like, you know, I'll add Jeff Bezos encouraging the most junior person or the person who might not have their most experience to speak first about what they've learned about a particular sector or company that they've come across, and then build up on top of that while also having universal standards to meet, whether it's, you know, due diligence, analysing the market the sector is in, and of course using the data that we have available from the company and outside the company as well. But of course the overall sort of sentiment underlying that is that you invest in things that you know, or at least you've done your best to try to get to know as far as possible.
Sat, what would success look like for this fund?
Yeah, sure. So we've got some oversight. So luckily our chair trustees, he used to be CFO at Carphone Warehouse. So he's sort of like, don't lose money. I'm joking. And so he's sort of been really supportive. And Giles Drury is one of our trustees as well, who's quite involved in this sector of asset management. So I think we've got good advice. And so essentially what we're going to try and do is it'll be 5 years in inception. And then hopefully, you know, if we do a good job, then it will continue. But I think initially it's, you know, from 2025 to 2030. And I think so success is, I think at this generation, you know, we're looking at things looking ahead. You know, we're going through an energy transition. There's, you know, a lot of change going on in the world. So I think it's a really great way. The first and foremost is to engage people with the markets. I think when you're talking about stock selection, I was thinking that, you know, these guys know about what trainers are in. So like Nike, JD Sports, you know, these kind of things that it engages people with, you know, what's going in, what's out. You know, some of the young people might have a competitive advantage, you know, because they're interested in, you know, is Superdry in or out at the moment, for example. But I think in regards to the success, it's about first and foremost education, engagement, understanding asset allocation, how to make a portfolio, how to have a group discussion, how to listen, you know, and share ideas. And then obviously, of course, the idea is a percentage obviously is to go back to the charity and obviously try and build the fund. But obviously we want it to go and benefit the charity so more young people can benefit. And I think the ultimate success would be is, you know, Wahid and Anya being able to pass the baton on to other young people so that we can kind of make it a full circle where, you know, they can support others.
Yeah. So it's not just about finance, isn't it? I suppose you're inculcating, you know, the responsibility for the returns are going back into the charity itself, aren't they?
You can now get 12 weeks of an Investor's Chronicle print and digital subscription for just £12. You'll get instant access to our website and our app, plus the magazine delivered to your door every week. Check the terms and conditions in the show notes for more information.
Sat and Anya, why do you have any questions for John about investing and how to approach managing a portfolio? After all, how long have you been doing it for now, John?
Over 60 years, okay. I think. Yes, over 60 years. So one hopes to have learned something over the years, but you never get everything right. You know, everyone makes mistakes. The key really is to hopefully get more things right than wrong. You never stop learning. I've been very impressed with hearing just how you're going to approach it all and the focus on individual companies. And I think we were talking a little bit earlier about investing in businesses that are already established and profitable and paying dividends rather than startup businesses or hope and prayer stocks, as it were, and certainly not cryptocurrencies. So it seems to me that you're already developing what I think is a sound approach to the stock market with the sorts of companies that you're looking at. And what is your method of research, really?
I would be quite traditional in this approach. I think the RNS is your friend. Sure. And what the company says in terms of its the CEO speeches or any statements, and the financials themselves, probably the best primary research. I mean, I study history at university. So as a primary resource, I think that's probably most valuable.
Sure.
And the real, I guess, value add as an investor comes from the judgment that you can make from that. And that comes from experience, but also the ability to synthesize the public data. Sure. That there is. And that's the real special source.
Well, I'm pleased that you say that, Nani, because I've come to the conclusion after 60-odd years of investing that there are only two things that you need for successful investment: common sense and patience. And patience is the most important. And that's the one that most people find the most difficult. And so they want instant returns, and that's why they're tempted by day trading or the movements in cryptocurrencies. But long-term investing and successful investing, I believe, requires common sense and particularly patience. And that's what most people haven't got. I sense that you actually, the three of you, have got that patience and are already understanding what actually goes into building up a successful portfolio and selecting successful individual shares, the sort of things that you're doing, you know, the company announcements, looking at trends. Some years ago, you could start seeing young people and older people, even people like me, wearing trainers, as it were, in the early days. So, yes, to invest in Nike then or JD Sports or similar was an obvious thing to do, a common sense thing to do. But did I do it? No, I didn't do it, as it were. So you see all the people on the trains with mobile phones, and what started to see them some years ago with mobile phones. Did I think of investing in Apple? No, I didn't. So sometimes you just sit down and you know, become conscious and focus on trends and what is happening and applying common sense to it and then extrapolating that into the companies that are in that sector.
Wahid, you touched on something before that I know is kind of bedrock of one of the bedrocks of John's philosophy about dividends. Is that an important thing to look at dividend paying stocks to get the real tangible return element of, you know, this company is just paid us back some money? That's kind of a nice thing. Is that a way of bringing to life returns for the investment committee that, you know, in a way that maybe just share price movements can't?
Yeah, 100%. The way I like to explain it is it's like cashback. You go to shopping, everyone likes a bit of cashback on their shopping, and you can get the same thing with stocks, and you still own the underlying asset, but you still receive extra money on top of that. So it's a bonus, it's an added bonus. And bearing in mind, before you invest in a stock or a company, you would have done your due diligence, your research, you know, why you invested it. So once you know it's a sound investment, like John said, common sense and patience is all you need. You won't get 10 out of 10. You're not going to get all the right picks, but at least the ones that you have picked, you know, have got a solid foundation for you to build on. And yeah, like I say, the dividends just make it all the more worthwhile.
Well, I for one will be following your progress very carefully, and it'll be really great to check in on how it's all going once it's all set up, guys. Just for the final section of this month's episode, I wanted to check in on a portfolio that's already up and running, and that's John's. Starting with the company we discussed at length in our third episode, John. That's the self-storage group, Lock and Store. No longer part of the portfolio, though. Why is that?
No longer part of the portfolio because they had a very attractive takeover bid from Shurgard a couple of weeks ago, which I thought would come along at some stage. In other words, not necessarily from Shurgard, but from someone, as it were, that they would exit. It has been a very successful investment from my point of view. But just to talk about it a little, because I think it will fit in with what we're trying to say to the three potential investors here. I first bought the stock at 134, I think it was. I think it was my first purchase price, 134p in 2013. At that stage, you know, I spotted the self-storage market, this particular company, Lock and Store, as a growing company, and it ticked a lot of boxes for me. It was a sector, the safe storage sector in this country was much less developed than in the United States. Lock and Store had one key driving shareholder called Andrew Jacobs, who had 20-odd% of the business. So we had skin in the game, which is a phrase that that we investors always look for or should look for. As I got to know the business, I became more confident and bought more shares. I think my lowest buying price was about 128, and I think I probably paid up to sort of 400 or 500p. In more recent years, and the takeout price, the bid price was £11, 10p. So, from my original purchase, obviously it was a great success, and the company has been paying an increased dividend over the years, and so the takeover bid came along. The price had been creeping up a little. Slightly surprising in some ways against the market movement generally. And I thought, well, maybe something's up. And then lo and behold, looking at the RNSs as I do at 7 o'clock in the morning when they all come out, lo and behold, there was this bid for Lock and Store, which obviously I was delighted about from every point of view, obviously making a nice profit, but also giving me the liquidity or the potential liquidity to reinvest and use the cash, including the profit, obviously, in reinvestment in other areas.
John, can I just ask on that point? So I know we spoke at the time of the takeover news, and you told me that you'd sold ahead. Obviously, the deal is not closed because it's not been delisted yet. And obviously, there was the risky market conditions that you felt at the time that necessitated selling out then. As you said, you know, there's several potential bidders for this company. Did you not think that we'd get this situation, which we've seen several other times this year in London, where a rival bidder has emerged for a company that's already in play? Did you not think that was a potential, or was the risk balance in your head? You just sort of calculated it.
Yes, one weighs it up. I took the view there are other companies, obviously, in the sector. The companies like Big Yellow and Safe Store some private ones. But I took the view that there are a fairly small number of companies, of significant companies in that sector. And my guess is, and I don't know this for sure, my guess is that the advisors to Lock and Store would have probably gently sounded out potential bidders. And I suspect Andrew Jacobs himself, who obviously is plugged into the industry, would have been aware of other players and maybe had an approach in the past. I don't know. But I formed the view that it was unlikely, although it's still possible, that another bidder may appear. I mean, the price has flickered above the bid price, so one can never be sure. And, of course, someone who isn't already in the sector might decide this is a great sector to be in. I will put a competing bid in, but I thought and still think that's unlikely, but never sure. But to me, the opportunity to take a fairly substantial amount of cash off the table, as it were, and redeploy, particularly as the Middle East was pretty hot, and could have gone either way. Was to me compelling, and that's what I did.
And I know you've been putting that cash back into a couple of companies, one being the Specialist Rental Group VP. The one that I wanted to sort of talk about a bit more detail is PZ Cousins, which is a business that's had a bit of a torrid time in many of its markets, both in terms of sales and owing to sort of adverse currency movements. You've previously said, I think, on this podcast, that you might be guilty of being a bit too loyal to this company. Have you? Why have you doubled down again?
A
little bit too loyal.
Are you talking about PZ?
To PZ. Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, it's obviously it's a company that I knew well and know relatively well. You and I was on the board many years ago as a non-executive director, and of course. You know, they were very successful. And at one stage, the capitalization grew to, I think, something like 1.8 billion. Sadly, it slipped all the way back a couple of weeks ago. I think it was valued at the low point about 370 million. So it really tumbled all the way down. A combination really of some mistakes of earlier management and particularly big problems in Nigeria with currency hasn't helped. And Nigeria is a very big market for PZ. Having said that, when looked at the value of the brands that and this is a little bit of Nania's area of interest. The brands that they've got, like Carex, which is our number one hand wash, Sanctuary, Morning Fresh, Child's Farm, which is natural children's toiletries, Imperial Leather, and Saint-Tropez, the tanning lotion. The value of those brands, it seemed to me, were well worth more, substantially worth more, than the then 360 odd million capitalization. I was really convinced that there was value at this level and there would be a recovery. And I bought a couple of weeks ago, added to a historic holding that I had because obviously I was involved on the board, and I bought at 86p, I think last week, with some of the proceeds from Lock and Store. Then yesterday, they had a trading statement, which was encouraging, not so much for basic trading, but indicating that they were really now going to look hard at the brands that they've got, focus on shareholder value. They said they were going to sell, that the group was far too stretched, and they were going to sell the Saint-Tropez tanning brand. Which I think it will prove to be. I hope it'll prove to be, very valuable, and that they were looking also at their African interests, their Nigerian interests, to see whether there should be some sort of sales or disposals. But for the first time in the statement, they were focusing very much talking about the phrase shareholder value, and also talking about selling some surplus manufacturing. Capabilities in Thailand, and all this sounded to me pretty encouraging. So I bought. The share price rose a little on this announcement yesterday, but nevertheless, I was convinced that still there was a lot of value to be had and a big recovery, hopefully coming. So having paid 86p last week, I actually paid yesterday. I think 99, nearly a pound. And I've also been trying to buy some more today at a little bit more. In other words, I still think that they're significantly undervalued, hopefully I'll be proved right, but one never knows.
John, can I just ask, in this kind of situation, I'm guessing you've probably experienced it a few times before, when a company's kind of, they kind of hit a bit of a bottom and they're looking to almost sell off parts of the business piecemeal to realise a greater value that investors like yourself think is trapped underneath its current situation. I mean, how easy is it actually for realizing that value? Because you've got, you've got counterparties who are aware that this is not a forced seller, but this is someone who wants to exit. Does that complicate, getting the best price that they think they could achieve for some of these brands?
No, I don't think so. I mean, these brands are significant and well known. There are some, of course, some very big players, of course, in this whole sort of consumer sector. Companies like Colgate and Procter and Gamble, You know, obviously the Unilevers here, and then there are, you know, big Indian and Chinese private companies as well, public companies, and very big businesses in America. So, you know, there could be, I'm sure, if with Saint-Tropez coming on the market, I suspect, you know, at the moment there are probably, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 companies worldwide, or individuals or private equity houses, who are looking at the value there. And I think at the end of the day, you know, a private auction will be held. Brands are very, very valuable these days. They take years to create. I mean, you take something like Carex, for example. Well, Carex is the number one hand wash. Every sort of second bathroom you go into has got Carex, as it were. Now, what is the value of that? So, you know, I think there is considerable value within, and that's why I think the share price hopefully will gently move forward as people realise this, and then ultimately, when there is a sale, and Saint-Tropez is realised, and some other hopeful sales are announced, then you might get a further jump in the share price. But we're talking here about, you know, a substantial company that is paying dividends, or the dividend was reduced, been around a long time, with value in the business. You can argue how much value there is there, but I take an optimistic view, and that's why I think I've been buying it around the right sort of level. And I can only do it because I've realised the cash from the takeover of Lok & Stork.
Yeah, therein lies the management in a portfolio. So, I mean, plenty to follow up with PZ Cousins. Just to finish, we've got a couple of listener questions, the first of which is from Andrew, who describes himself as a big fan over many years, who has followed you into quite a few companies, including Lok & Stork, it turns out. He asks whether you've ever considered owning AG Barr, which he says he sees as a classic John Lee UK stock, established profitable business, growing dividend, skin in the game, as we were talking about earlier. Is that one you've run the rule over before?
Well, I know of AG Barr. I've never invested in them. I could well have done, as Andrew says, you know, they tick all the boxes. I've actually invested in a very similar company over the years, called Nichols Vimto. And in fact, I believe that Barrs and Nichols were talking about a merger some years ago, which in the end, I didn't get anywhere. And so I'm in Nichols in that soft drink sector rather than AG Barr. Nichols, very solid business, very popular, growing brand in this country. Vimto is actually growing here. And in the Gulf states, Vimto is hugely popular. It's the post-Ramadan drink. And Nichols have also got a lot of cash. I think capitalization is about 350 million. They've got about 70 million in cash. And quite a nice dividend yield, about 4.5%. It's a good, solid business, and one that one day might be taken over, just as indeed AG Barr might. I think Andrew's on the right lines, but you can't be in everything.
So another one finally, Vonnie asks your thoughts on SNU and its dividend, noting that this is one you've not mentioned for a while. Is that still in the...
It's not in my portfolio. It's in one or two of the portfolios that I influence. It has done very, very well over the years, been a great growth story, and I was in it earlier myself. Motor Finance, I think originally going right back, it was sort of fairly basic money lending, and then developed into Motor Finance. And in more recent years, they also started a division in building and bridging finance for small builders, which has gone very well. Family control business, which I like. Steady growth. The only risk with SNU, or the biggest risk at the moment, is I think it's the FCA investigation into commissions paid some years ago by customers who took out finance to buy cars. It looks as though some of those companies who provided that finance are going to have to pay compensation to some of those who unknowingly paid commissions in the price that they paid on the financing. And so Lloyds Bank has been mentioned as as a bank that potentially could have quite a big liability there, not to the extent that it would really threaten the strength of Lloyds Bank, but nevertheless significant. And a company like S&U also, I think, is a little bit vulnerable. So companies in that sector, like Close Brothers and S&U, have been hit. And also I've been conscious of that in Secure Trust, which is a small banking operation. But I believe that their potential exposure in this area is really very small indeed.
It just goes to show, doesn't it? I mean, investing, you've got to keep tabs on so many different stories at any one time. I think I'd probably prefer to delegate it to a team, as you guys are doing. But yeah, lots to explore in our next episode, which of course includes any questions you'd like to put to John, which you can do by emailing me at alex.newman@ft.com. Until then, all that's left for me to say is to thank you for listening, to thank John for your thoughts and time, as well as a big thank you to Sat and Anya and Wahid, and to Maddie Apthorpe and Andrew Georgiadis on the mixing desk. Until next time.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.